You are tuned into the Bernard Bergen Podcast.
Thanks again, guys, for tuning in and listening. You know, I am empowered to be doing a part two with Najah, who graciously, you know, blocked some time to help us go deep here. Panic attacks, anxiety attacks, depression, and suicide, you know, has been something that's been on the forefront of the conversation, no matter the space you find yourself in. In the American context, we've lost celebrities, etc. To my military listeners, you know of someone who've taken their own life, or someone with severe depression, or someone who is suffering with anxiety or PTSD, and for whatever reasons internally, they don't want to go seek help. So I think this conversation will bring a lot of the research to the forefront and a lot of the how-tos as well. And I know that, you know, there is an opioid crisis. So we're not saying that everyone has to do this without meds. Everyone has to find a way without, you know, their doctor's input. But we're saying that there is a way to do that. And I am talking to someone who has done that for their own lives. And Najah, I'd love a quick recap of, you know, when you experienced, you know, what you could clearly define as an anxiety attack or a panic attack. And then what was the process to where you are today?
Yes. Hi, good morning. And thank you, Bernard, for setting this up and us being able to dive a little bit deeper on this episode. So just a quick recap, you know, I experienced my first really horrible panic attack April of last year. It was very debilitating. I felt like I couldn't breathe. I thought that I was having a heart attack. I thought I was dying. I ended up going to the hospital. From that day, the panic attacks kept on happening, and I ended up checking myself into a psychiatric hospital for 4 days. And that was a whole journey on its own. It was a horrific experience. Being in there, I kind of saw that a lot of things that they do were counterproductive to me healing and to me get over the anxiety. What triggered my anxiety was the death of my brother, you know, committing suicide, and a lot of the other things that I had on my plate. Being overwhelmed and dealing with stress and dealing with fear, all of it kind of just compiled and pretty much just had an anxiety breakdown. And from there, I began my journey researching this beast and became like a, you know, the opponent. I need to find out, you know, what depression and anxiety does so I can beat it. So just being able to study it and constantly staying on top of new knowledge and new ways to be able to treat. And then learning how to do therapeutic lifestyle changes versus taking medication. So that's been my journey so far.
Yep, that was, you know, a great recap. What I want to do before we dive into asking what is anxiety and what is a panic attack, I would love for you to take some time to just tell us about life before that moment, and maybe a few years before that moment, maybe 2 years out from when that first anxiety attack, that first panic attack was a part of your life.
Yeah. The last time we were talking, I was telling you how I considered myself to be a tow truck and how it's very rare that you see a tow truck being towed, because a tow truck's job is to carry the weight of other vehicles. And so it's very rare that you see a tow truck actually broken down, because like that's their job, is to carry other cars. And so that's pretty much how my life looked before my I was running around carrying the weight of other people. I was carrying the weight of death. I was carrying the weight of my aunt being sick. I was carrying the weight of broken relationships. I was carrying the weight of family issues that weren't resolved. I had a father that was in and out of prison and on drugs, and a mother that was kind of distant. My siblings were all over the place. So before this 2 years, I had a lot on my plate. I was working. I was trying to build a legacy, and I just kept pushing, kept going. I kept picking up a car, dropping it off, kept going. And I never actually stopped to really look at my life in its totality and see kind of the things that I needed to heal. I kept just putting band-aids on stuff. I would get cut, I would get shot, and I would just put a band-aid on it and say, we'll get to that later. And that's kind of what happens in our lives. We're moving so much that we just put band-aids on things, or we put things in a closet and we'll say, we'll get back to it later. And then it begins to fester. And I believe that's kind of what was happening in my life. I was in a relationship that was kind of all over the place, and I was grieving my brother. He had took his life, and we were the closest of close of any two siblings that you could ever see. And it was hard for me to just accept, you know, that he was actually gone. I never blamed God. I never, you know, questioned it. It was just more of accepting that I wasn't going to be able to have him here physically with me anymore, and trying to push past that, you know, being strong and okay, I'm not going to let this bother me. So it was 2 years of really just putting away pain in a closet and not letting it purge through me.
Putting away pain. Powerful, powerful, powerful. Now, to those who still don't want to do their own research and fully understand what an anxiety attack is, what a panic attack is, can you break that down for them?
Yeah. The simplest way that I'm going to be able to put it based on experience and studying is an anxiety attack is pretty much fear. I've learned that depression lives in the past and anxiety lives in the future. So when you're depressed, you're usually thinking about things that have happened that you can't control. And when you're dealing with anxiety, you're thinking about things that could happen that you can't control. So anxiety is pretty much built up fear, which, you know, anxiety is normal. It's a normal reaction to stress. And it can actually be beneficial in some situations. So we are, you know, in a room full of people that, you know, look kind of sketchy, and you think someone may pull out a weapon, you may get a little bit anxious. That's kind of like your fight or flight response kicking in. So I'm sure in the military, that's something that people experience all the time. You get a little anxiety when you're in a situation that seems a little bit dangerous. Fear kicks in. So it's not a bad thing to have a little bit anxiety. It's when the anxiety becomes debilitating, to where it hinders your ability to function normally, where you can't breathe, you're having tingling in your limbs, you feel like you're having a heart attack, you're starting to sweat. When those things happen, we sometimes start to avoid situations that can trigger that. So like at our job, or college students when they're in school, like when a test comes up. So anxiety is something that pretty much, I want to say almost 30% or more of all adults are going to experience at some point in their lives, because it's just something that naturally happens in you. But it's literally heightened fear. Anxiety is fear. It is you thinking about something that you can't control, something that's going to go wrong. You're ruminating on a negative thought over and over again. And that is what literally creates anxiety. And then it becomes physical. You have physical signs that start to show up of the thinking of it. So it'll be, you know, like I said, feeling like you're having a heart attack, not being able to breathe, your limbs are tingling. And then with that, sometimes causes, you know, depression, because now you're really sad that you can't enjoy the things that you used to enjoy because you're so anxious. And then you start feeling like, well, what's the point of living? So it all kind of correlates together, the anxiety, the depression, and then even the suicidal thoughts.
That's powerful, because I think many of us never truly work to understand the process. And we respond to the physical way more deliberately than we do to the mental. What would you say to those people who are just ignoring their mental state? And like you mentioned, they're in that tow truck mode. They're just pushing, picking people up, taking people where they need to be, dropping them off. And they're never really, you know, just taking some time to understand, like, man, I am worried or fearful I will lose my job. I am worried or fearful that, hey, I'm deploying again and I could lose my life on the battlefield. Or, hey, I'm a police officer and, you know, my job is stressful and, you know, I don't want a bad day out today. Or the mother just worrying about their children. My children are at school or they're on the football field, basketball court, the tennis court. I'm just worried. What would you say is a sign that, hey, maybe you need to address that in a deliberate way? Or I guess that it's a normal level of anxiety or natural worry. Where should we, you know, draw the line of saying, okay, that might be too far?
I think definitely being mindful, practicing mindfulness. I know it's not something that we do a lot because we're so busy, but being mindful of our thoughts, being intentional about why we're doing something or why we're feeling a certain way. So for me, I know it's very difficult for people to want to sit with their own thoughts. For me, it's being mindful of, okay, where am I at right now? What am I doing right now? How do I feel right now? Being constantly aware of how you feel. And then also, I think a huge thing for me is my faith. I mean, the word that you stamped on that statement was worry. Me being a person of faith and understanding how God works in my life, you know, God is like, you know, you can't add any more hours to your day by worrying. You can't fix anything by worrying. Being able to have a level of faith that says, no matter what my circumstance is, God is in control. I always tell people, you know, a lot of people, when they lose a loved one, they question God. I never once questioned God when my brother took his life, because I always believe that, you know, God is in control. He has a reasoning for everything, that something is going to come of this, even if we don't know what it is. And in my brother's passing, I have been able to help so many other people heal. So even in that, it has been something good. But going back to thoughts, I do believe that being, again, if your anxiety and your worry is hindering your ability to function normally. So if you're not sleeping well, if you're not eating, if you are constantly crying, if you are constantly shaking, if you are physically ill all the time, those are signs that this is not normal anxiety, because now it's starting to affect your normal patterns of behavior. If you're saying, I don't want to go to work today, I can't go to the class today. Even if you're a parent and you're trying to helicopter your kids, you know, I don't want my kids going here. I can't have my kids going there. I can't. If it's affecting your normal ability to live, then I would say that it has gone too far. And that's when you should try and seek a little bit of help or talk to someone about it. I do also think that there are several different types of anxiety. So people have panic attacks, separation anxiety, there are different phobias. So really like understanding kind of where your anxiety is coming from. If it is your job, or if it is your school, or if it is your spouse, getting to the root of it and not just kind of like the branches of the problem, but actually the root of why am I feeling this way? Taking, you know, account of everything that's going on in your life. I really do think that having quiet moments to just be able to think, writing out your thoughts, reading them over, will kind of give you a visual of like how you're feeling. Being intentional about your day and the things that you're doing is another thing. Like, why am I doing this? What am I benefiting from doing this? And then one of the major things that kind of helped me with anxiety is gratitude. When I am ruminating on negative thoughts, I try to go back to what I'm grateful for. So if I'm thinking about, oh my goodness, you know, am I going to perform well at this job? Just thinking of, I'm so grateful to be able to have a job that pays me, where I can pay my bills. Going into gratitude, if I'm worried about, you know, even in the military, I'm going out and I don't know if I'm going to come back. Being grateful that I have this moment with my family and friends, I am able to serve my country. Just going into switching your thoughts to try and think about something that you're grateful for, I think is something to practice. Even when you're not anxious, just getting up in the morning and practicing gratitude will help you kick anxiety before it even starts.
I love that. And I think that's real practical, because gratitude is something we can practice immediately and shift the energy that's going on within us before it takes on those physical responses. Now, let's talk about the physical a bit. You said it could feel like you're having a heart attack. It could cause, you know, just different pains in the body. What would you say are the most common based on your research?
The most common, and from the most interviews that I've done, everyone says that they feel like they're dying. And I know it sounds really crazy. You really feel like you can't breathe. And it does kind of feel like your heart is racing. You may have pain in your chest, pain in your back, and your breathing is labored. So it does feel like almost like you're dying. And the more you feel it, you get even more scared, because then you feel like you are dying, especially if you don't know it's a panic attack. When I first had mine, I've never had a panic attack in my life. So I'm waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning in my bed. I'm like, oh my goodness, my breathing's getting bad. And as it started getting worse, I was like, oh my goodness, I'm having a heart attack. And as my heart started beating more, now mentally, I've already started to believe I'm having a heart attack. So now I'm actually having one, right? So the more your mind starts to believe that something is happening to you, it actually keeps on happening. So I ran downstairs to call my aunt. And at this time, like, my breathing's getting worse. I'm like, oh my goodness, I think I'm going to pass out. I think I'm literally dying. Like, what's happening? So when you don't know that you're having an anxiety attack, it can be very scary. It can literally feel like you're dying. The most common thing is your breathing and heart racing. So if you know that you're completely healthy, if you know that you've been, to your doctor and you don't have any issues with your heart, you don't have any asthma or issue with your breathing, and all of a sudden
you know, you start having issues breathing and you start, your heart starts beating fast, I would say go to the hospital. When they run all the tests, they're going to probably let you know that everything is fine. And you're probably going to find that you're actually having a panic attack, actually having anxiety. Crying is another one. Not being able to breathe, kind of having really fast heart palpitations, but also like crying uncontrollably can be a panic attack because it's just so much fear at one time. The brain is just triggered. And at that point, you're kind of just like, oh my gosh, I don't know what to do. Like, I said that anxiety is a normal reaction to being in a bad or stressful situation. So when that's heightened and you don't know what to do, it's almost like being a cat in a corner that's getting attacked by a dog. It's just heightened. So I would definitely say if you are having trouble breathing, you know that you've been stressed out lately, definitely go to a doctor and get checked 100%.
Okay. Now, just to be more practical and deliberate with the action steps. So you go to the doctor to get checked out, and maybe the doctor doesn't have the best information on what you're experiencing. Is there language that you can use to get things to where they need to be, or to get in front of the right person so that you can start on the path to recovery?
You know, this is a hard one too. Being in the medical field myself, it's really sad to say that some, you know, doctors care more than others. I know it sounds horrible. You can get in front of some doctors, you can ask the appropriate questions and say, you know, why do you think I'm feeling this way? Like, why I don't have any heart issues. I don't have any asthma or breathing issues. Why do you think that I'm, you know, having these attacks? And some doctors will say, it does sound like you're having anxiety. It does. Maybe you have stressful situations going on in your life, and they will recommend you maybe to a therapist or a psychologist to talk to someone. And then some doctors will say, you know, you probably just need some more sleep. So it's really a hit and miss depending on what doctors you go to. I would say, and I know we're in the era of Google, and I know a lot of people Google information. I know for me, when I start having some type of like an itch or a rash or something, I'll Google like, what causes red marks on a hand, you know, and looking up different things. I say being proactive with your health is important. Talking to doctors, you can even Google information, try and look up different doctors in your area that deal with anxiety, that deal with depression. They have lots of different psychologists. They even have one of the foundations that I work with is the, what was the foundation I was working with recently? Was the Lee Young Thompson Foundation. And that was the young actor that ended up committing suicide. And they are based out in Georgia, and they are really big on like ending the stigma of depression and anxiety. So when you call them, they give you resources and numbers of people you can talk to. And then you'll be able to go over your symptoms with them. Like, this is what I'm feeling. This is how often I'm feeling it. And they'll be able to say, okay, it sounds like it's anxiety. It sounds like it's panicking. Depending on the severity of it. Like I said, if it's debilitating, if it's something that's happening to you all the time and it's causing issues from your work, you definitely want to see someone. If it's something that's just happening periodically, every blue moon, and it's not debilitating, I would say lifestyle is going to be the biggest thing for you. Really analyzing what's going on in your life, how often you're sleeping, how many stressful situations you're taking on, the people that are in your life, you know, things that you may not have healed from. So it's probably going to be really beneficial to determine whether it's debilitating or not first. You know, if I'm having these panic attacks, how often am I having them? Is it keeping me from doing things? And then trying to get a hold of local resources that will benefit, like, you know, anxiety disorders, or just asking the appropriate questions.
Now, would you say that with a more connected world, and I'm speaking specifically about social media, not just the ability, you know, to communicate with people all over the world almost instantly, but with the proliferation of social media, you know, do you think that could be a trigger of why anxiety, even depression, is on the rise? And if so, what can we start to do with our social media habits to help with our recovery or help with our just more stillness and intentionality so that we're in the best state we can be in mentally to avoid getting into that deeper place of where anxiety now has physical symptoms?
Yeah, social media and technology overall plays a huge role on mental health. more than we probably even think. They did these studies, and this one is really crazy to me. They put these college students in a classroom, and they said, we are going to give you two choices. You can sit in your chair for 20 minutes with your own thoughts and kind of just be bored, so to speak. Or there is a machine over here in the corner that if you touch it, it'll administer a shock to your body. So they had the opportunity of being bored for 20 minutes or administering a shock to their body. And 90% of these students chose the shock multiple times. So what this study was showing was that we have a hard time being quote unquote bored. We always have to have some type of information. We do not like to sit with our own thoughts. We're uncomfortable with even having, I mean, they could have even had conversations with each other and they chose not to. They chose an actual shock to their body multiple times. So that lets you know that we are in a state that we are not comfortable being bored. We're not comfortable with not having something to do constantly. So we are on our phones pretty much 24/7 because we don't like the idea of sitting idle. Idle time is just not something that we want to do. The other thing that you're seeing with young people, I want to say like it's the generation of just screens, is when they did this, you know, in order to build empathy in people, because you're seeing a lack of empathy. And a lack of empathy, you have people being more susceptible to bullying online and things like that that also trigger a lot of depression and anxiety. When you're a toddler and you're playing with other toddlers, a toddler takes a toy from another toddler and that toddler cries. That's kind of how you develop empathy in a child. They get to see the reaction, a negative reaction of something that they did to someone else. When we are behind screens all the time, we don't get that interaction with humans, the human connection anymore. So we're not really seeing what our words and what our actions are doing to someone else. When we're telling someone you should kill yourself, you're ugly, on a screen, we're not actually seeing that person's face and seeing what it's actually doing to them. So it's not building, we're no longer building empathy in our children and in our young people, which is so easy for them to, you know, record someone being beat up or be, you know, just not, I don't want to use the word horrible, but we're kind of raising a horrible generation of people that lack empathy, and that's from being on the screen. The other thing is being able to compare yourself to other people. When you're online all the time, you're able to compare your life, which you may have been really, really grateful for before you got to see Sarah's life and how much she had. And so spending so much time on our phones and on social media is really starting to make people anxious. Am I not doing enough? Am I not good enough? Why don't I have this? How come I don't look like this? And it's constantly feeding your mind negative thoughts about who you are, constantly being susceptible to bullying and other people's opinions of yourself. So this era is really dangerous because when it, you know, as far as your mental health goes, when you are constantly feeding your mind something negative, you're only going to breed something negative from that. And so you're seeing a lot more levels of depression. You're seeing 8-year-olds wanting to commit suicide. I mean, eight. When I was eight, I was thinking about what color, you know, in the rainbow was my favorite, you know. But seeing 8-year-olds wanting to commit suicide, you're now knowing that that age group lacks a lot of empathy, and that is from being on screens all the time and not really actually having human connections with other children in the proper format. And it's actually really sad because when I was growing up and we didn't have, and this is so weird, we didn't have, like, you know, cell phones and things like that, we were forced to be able to go outside. And that is one of the main things that's kind of an antidote to breaking this screen generation is going outside and spending time in nature. It has been proven that when you get burned out from being bored, from scrolling, from, you know, all of the social media and all the technology, going outside and taking a walk in nature down the street is actually a huge antidote to dealing with, you know, kids being on their screens for, you know, long periods of time.
Man, that's powerful, yet I can clearly see how that's going to be super unpopular. But I think as we start to have more and more people admitting their struggles, I think the reality of making that change, getting back to nature, getting back to playing, you know, telling your 8-year-olds they can't have a cell phone, that's going to become popular again. I know it's scary for many to deal with the tantrums thrown when you say no screen time, but if it's going to protect their mental health and protect them from It's so weird to say the word online bullying because it's such a different space. But the reality is you can have negative comments times a million in seconds. And if someone's reading that and feeding into that and they don't yet have a clear sense of self, wow, talk about a pressure that can break you down. So I love right. that, you know, you gave us not just the strategies, but what the research shows to be proven. So I just want to challenge, you know, anyone listening that on your calendar, you know, don't think about it. On your calendar, block some time for you to go on a walk. Find your nearest park. Find an area that's as quiet as possible. Scary thought, you know, if you have to bring your cell phone with you, turn it off and just walk and enjoy it. You know, if you
yeah, and it's also too when you're talking about, you know, telling an 8-year-old, you know, we're not going to be able to give you a cell phone, it's replacing that with something that's intentional, doing some family activities, you know, playing games with them that's going to build their mind, word games, puzzles, giving them things. And I know it almost sounds boring, but you can make, you know, you train a child up in the way that they should go. This is the Bible again. This is my faith talking. Train a child up in the way that they should go, and they won't depart from that when they get older. So as a parent, you have a responsibility to your child's health, mental health, as well as physical health. And so what a lot of parents are doing, they're taking the easy way out. And I'm challenging parents, don't take the easy way out when it comes to your kids, because you could be a parent that walks in and finds their kid, you know, dead. That's the reality. I mean, that's just being real and raw. Do not take the easy way out when it comes to your children. These are your children. These are your legacy. And if you love them and you have to make a choice between, you know, I'm tired and I have to cook dinner and I have to work, so it's easier for me to just give them the YouTube on the iPad and walk away. That's easier. But what's not easy is burying your child. And so I'm challenging you to not take the easy way out, to make it a little bit more difficult from your, you know, children, and offering them something that's more intentional for them to be able to gravitate to. And if you have teens in the house, I'm challenging you to take your teens out to do different things with your teens. A lot of parents just let teens, you know, go at, you know, at they're 15 years old, just let them do what they want to do. I'm challenging you as well, if you have teens in the house, to be able to take your teens out and do things with them and be intentional about it. Be nosy. Be a little bit nosy in your kid's business and find out what their favorite music is and what their favorite movie is, and see how you can kind of navigate taking them to the movies and you know, basically filling them up with positive things. Also, affirmation. Affirm your children at home so they don't have to get that affirmation online from other people. It doesn't matter what Susie has or what Kaylin has or what she, or you know, what she looks like. Affirm your children. Let them know that they're beautiful. Let them know that they're smart. And go through their social media with them if they do have social media. Go through some of the comments with them and look. Have access to their social media so you can see what's being posted on their account. So you have to really be proactive with your children. I feel like a lot of parents are just dropping the ball and letting the school raise their kids and letting, you know, iPhones raise their kids. It's the easy way out. And I'm telling you that it's a lot harder to, you know, unlearn a bad habit than to learn a good habit in the beginning.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And I, you know, I just want to say the same thing, encouraging parents to really look at what you signed up for. We're not saying it's easy, but you are helping to shape the next generation of leaders. And that is, as we all can admit, a full-time role with very little breaks. But if you basically overlook where you can help your child get a head start on what the world is really like today by helping them be self-assured and know who they really are and know who they belong to and find their voice sooner than later. I love the challenge you said, like you don't ever want to be the parent who gets the phone call or who walks in and finds out the worst of the worst occurred because of the pressures of what this social online insta life created. So I thank you for saying what you said and just reminding parents that there is still room to be nosy, to be a parent, to govern, to guide, and to lead in their children's lives.
Yes. There's also the last part of that is there are also apps on your phone. And I think even Instagram has this built in that tells you how many hours you spent on social media. Put that on your child's phone. at the end of the week or at the end of the day, go over how many hours they spent on their cell phone or how many hours they spent on one particular app, and ask them intentional questions. Why are you spending this much time on there? What other activities could we be doing besides this? Being intentional about why are you even on the app? How is it feeding your spirit? How is it, you know, how are you being productive? So looking at those, and I have that on my phone because I'm guilty of being on the phone way too long sometimes. And so I have that on my phone and it pops up and lets you know you've reached an hour, you know, on this app or this social media to let you know, like, there's about 10 to 20 hours sometimes that kids spend on their phone from the time they wake up to the time they go to bed. I think the most common is 10 to 15 hours a day, 10 to 15 hours. That's over a full-time job that they spend on their phone. So having that app, I think, is really helpful too. So you can kind of see, gauge where you and your children are with your technology.
Very, very, very timely and informative. Now, I have an article in front of me, and it was published in April of 2017, and it talks about more than one in five American adults are on medication for psychiatric disorders, such as anxiety and depression, something that we've been going deep on. Now, your journey to healing and wholeness, you challenged the idea of traditional medication for anxiety and depression. Tell us about that journey. And to those looking to start down that road, we'd love to hear, how do you start?
So this was the key to this journey is actually doing the work. It takes a lot more work to try and heal without medication than it does with medication. And so you really have to be willing to do the work when it comes to therapeutic lifestyle changes. And that's the route that I went. When I was in the hospital, we were forced to take medication for those 4 days that I was there. It made me numb. It made me sick. I had never taken medication for anything in my life before. And so I knew when I got out that this wasn't the road that I wanted to take. And, you know, I'm speaking specifically of depression and anxiety because there are, you know, bipolar disorders and schizophrenia and things that people probably really do need medication for. So I'm by no means saying throw your medication out the window, don't listen to your doctors, but being very intentional about your treatment is really important. When we're looking at the research of medication for mental health, we're seeing that the percentage of people taking antidepressants is going up, but the rate of people healing from their depression has not risen. So you have, you know, 70% more people on medication, but nobody, the rate of people actually getting off medication or healing has not gone up. So that's saying that the medication is pretty much maybe stabilizing some people, or some people are just getting addicted to it because it's a temporary fix. But long term, we're not seeing any really good long term effects. And I think that if you are on medication, combining therapeutic lifestyle change would probably be the best route. And what I mean by that is looking at the areas of your life that need to be changed. One of the areas of the life is your social connections. And I start there because that's a pretty big one for most people, is who you're connected with, your family, your friends, who you, like your five core people that you have in your life. When I talk to people and say, you know, who are the five people in your life that can pray for you, or that if something traumatic was happening, you could call. A lot of people don't have core people in their life. So that's something to focus on and look at. Physical activity is another one. How often do you get physical activity in your life? And I don't just mean going to the gym, because the human body wasn't really even designed for gym equipment. It was designed for just like hunter-gatherers, being outside, lifting, walking, doing work around the house. How often do you really get physical activity? Because physical activity actually boosts serotonin to the brain. So physical activity, exercise, will actually give the same chemical to the brain as antidepressant does. So how often are you working out? How often are you getting physical activity? Sleep, looking at your different sleep patterns, like how often are you getting enough sleep? Are you staying up 15 and 20 hours, you know, past the time you're supposed to, so you can get a project done or so you can watch a movie? Are you on Netflix up late? Looking at your sleep patterns and how much sleep that you get. Your food, a major, major one that a lot of people are kind of hopping on this train now, is the food, the ratios of omega-6s to omega-3s in the brain. I didn't know this, and this was a huge one for me, realizing, and I'm not sure if we went over this in part one or not, but realizing how our food has changed drastically. So omega-6s is what causes inflammation in the body. We need inflammation. And so inflammation is good for you unless you have an excess of it. So omega-6s will cause inflammation, and omega-3s is what causes the body to not have inflammation. So basically, a long time ago, we had a ratio of 1-to-1. We had just as many omega-6s as we did omega-3s in the body. And this is when we had hunter-gatherers. Our meat was not grain-fed. We had lots of fruits and vegetables. And so we were good. Now, with all of the sugar and the fast foods and high meat diets and our meat being grain-fed and not grass-fed, and what that means is omega-6s come from grains. So if you are eating beef or you're eating pork, I'm not a meat eater myself, but if you're eating beef or pork and those animals are being fed grains, they have an influx of omega-6s in them, which means your body's getting an influx of omega-6s, and that causes the brain to swell. When you have swelling in the brain, that is what causes depression. So what doesn't happen when you go see a psychologist, most psychologists do not ask you, what is your diet like? You know, what are you feeding yourself? How often are you sleeping? They're not really asking these questions. They kind of just ask you how you feel. You tell them you feel horrible. You're thinking about suicide. They say, let's try you on this medication and see how it goes. And you essentially become a little bit of a guinea pig until they find what medication works for you or numbs you the best. And so the challenge is actually wanting to do the work to look at the six areas of your life and say, how can I make changes in these areas of my life? Actually making those changes and then seeing the results of them. So it's, I'm being honest, it's really hard because you have to be intentional about the people you're around, about your health, about your diet, about sleeping. It's really taking your life seriously. And a lot of people don't want to do that. A lot of people don't want to do that. They would rather have a magic pill because, you know, with social media and with everything that's going on, we are a really fast society. So we want a quick fix to everything, you know, plastic surgery, and we just want fast diets. We want everything to be a quick fix. And when it comes to your mental health, there is no quick fix. There just isn't one.
Yeah, that is so revealing. I know so many people are frowning right at this moment because they want that instant relief. And the truth is, you're talking lifestyle change. Now, What did that look like for you? And what were some of the highlights and positive moments that you didn't know was coming in your future as you made that lifestyle change?
Oh my goodness. With physical activity, I remember, you know, having a friend who's a trainer. I love her so much. She's amazing. And I would start training with her and then I would, no, I don't feel like doing this. And I would stop. I wasn't really like, you know, motivated to keep on working out. When I got out of the psych hospital, I was like, where is she at? I called her. We worked out, you know, 3 months straight, you know, with me not breaking it. And me getting back into the whole workout regimen. And she was like, wow, this is the longest you've ever been consistent. And so it was really me saying, I want to live. I really want to live. I'm going to do whatever it takes. So my physical activity, I was really intentional about getting a trainer, working out, even going for walks outside. My food, I have a lot of people in my family that are vegan. And I switched back to veganism, just making sure I had, you know, lots of fruits and vegetables, not eating meats, not eating dairy, just really being intentional about the things that I put in my body. I also, one of the hardest things for me was being intentional about my friendships and my family, learning what friendships and what relationships were toxic to my mental health. I even went on social media and I unfollowed every page that I felt was going to trigger something negative in my mind. So any pages that I was following where it was like half naked men or half naked women for that matter, things that were like a whole bunch of fatty foods, anything that was going to be counterproductive to me healing, I unfollowed it. Relationships that I had that I was just kind of, you know, being around the people just because I was bored. I was like, no, I have to be intentional about the people that are in my life. If they're not feeding my soul, if they're not positive, if we're not growing together, I can't do it. I'm not going to be around them on a consistent basis. So I was going through and I was pretty much doing cleanup in my life. That's pretty much what it looked like. It was sitting back saying, what parts of my life am I going to have to adjust in order for me to heal? And I was ready to do it. I'm like, I'm doing the work. I don't want to end up, you know, with this disease for the rest of my life. I do not, you know, my father's side of the family has a history of mental illness. And I was letting the lie go into my mind when I was in the hospital. Like, you're going to end up just like your father's side of the family. You're going to end up just like your brother. And I was adamant, like, I am not going to let this be the end of my story. I am going to use this pain for something. And so the word intentional is like ingrained in my heart and in my mind, being intentional about everything that I do in my life. When I'm eating, why am I eating right now? Am I actually hungry? Is this feeding my spirit or is this going to be detrimental spirit? What am I listening to? So just taking like, you're responsible for your life. You are. If you want to leave your life into the hands of doctors, into the hands of everybody else, then you're going to be at their mercy and what they think is best for you. And only you know you. So with me and God, most of all, a lot of times depression and anxiety is because people are hopeless. When you don't have hope for something better, you would just think that this is the way it's always going to be. I'm always hopeful that this is not the end of my story. And so when you have God in your life, he lets you know that there is hope in him. And so no matter your circumstance, and so what that looked like for me was waking up every day saying, no matter how I feel this morning, I know that it can get better. And so how can I help that get better along? What can I do today to help that get better along? And so that was my journey in just every single day being intentional about where I was, what I ate, what I did. And once you train your mind and your body to do those things, it'll just come second nature. It's not going to be like, oh, I wonder if I should eat meat today or not eat meat. Or I wonder if I should watch porn or not watch porn. I wonder, it just goes into a second nature of what you're doing and what you're feeding your mind and your body.
That was amazing. And that was worth taking people through what they can look forward to. Because I think a lot of times we talk about the benefits of, and people are like, well, I don't really want that. You know, and I think you really help break people down to the level of, okay, so you can be in that state of panic, anxiety, depression, or here is something you can look forward to. And here is what I did in my life to get there. And I love that we're presenting multiple solutions, because I think one of the hindrances to people onboarding with the things that work is that so many people feed the message that it's this way. And I love that you said, when I went through my struggle, finding my trainer was so much easier. You know, I am going to use this pain for something. And I think sometimes we have to, as people who love people who might be struggling, who might be in these moments, create a safe space for them to find their bottom or find their fail or find their own path, instead of, you know, I think the intervention mindset became so popular and so many people are like, well, our way. And when we look at their lives, we're like, well, I don't want what you're talking about. I don't want what your life represents, you know, versus saying, here's a way that worked for me. It's something you can consider if you're having some of the same struggles or some of the same trials that I have overcome. And I think that was well said.
Yes. If you are taking medication, I will say that at least try to incorporate the therapeutic lifestyle changes to your life along with your medication. Because for some people, the medication gets them motivated enough to do the work. So sometimes taking the medication in the beginning kind of stabilizes them enough to say, okay, now I can think clear. Now what do I do? So the goal is to not be dependent on medication. I'm not saying that you'll probably never need it. It's to not be dependent upon it, because what happens when you don't have that medication? And then the side effects of the medication. I mean, you have 80% of medications, the side effect is suicidal thoughts. So you're really playing Russian roulette when you're taking a medication because you don't know if it's going to make you better or worse. So that's the scary part about it. And so that's the reason why I think that working on lifestyle changes is something that you can incorporate on your own, that you can really pay attention to, and that you can actually see something from. So I just want to give the six areas of lifestyle so you guys can know what areas they are, and you can Google these or look them up. Your food is one. So your omega-3s to your omega-6s, really paying attention to how many omega-3s and omega-6s you're putting into your body. Omega-3s are anything that's like fruit, vegetable, like green, leafy vegetables. Those are your omega-3s. Your omega-6s are going to be like grains, nuts, things like that. So paying attention to what you put in your body. Your thinking, like having anti-rumination strategies. Rumination means thinking about something negative over and over and over. So anti-rumination strategies, just thinking, like trying to think positive, the gratitude we talked about earlier. Exercise is a huge one. It literally changes the brain. Working out and exercise literally changes the brain. So that's a major one. Light exposure is another one. And I know there was an article that I asked you to read a little while ago, or that we had brought up, about the 16 or 14 different states that have a little bit more depression than others, depending on where they live. So if you're in a state that has long winter months or is gloomy a lot, you sometimes experience depression a lot more, because a light exposure, light actually changes the mind as well. So being able to get out into actual sunlight, we spend a lot of time in offices, we spend a lot of time indoors on computers, we spend a lot of time in classrooms. Being able to go outside for a walk is a huge deal. Getting sunlight, that is one of the six areas of lifestyle change. Social support, who are the people that are around you that support you? Whether it be a church, whether it be a small group, whether it be even if you're like in AA meetings or, you know, something like that, who is your core support group? Focusing on that, getting that aligned with your core beliefs, and then also your sleep hygiene. How much are you sleeping? Making sure you're getting 8 hours, making sure you're turning your phone off and putting it in another room when you go to bed so you're not up scrolling all night. Those are the six areas that you really have to be intentional about if you want to try and work on your healing without medication. Write down the word intentional. If you don't get anything else from this message, get the word intentional, making sure you're doing things on purpose. That's really how you actually live. Even if you don't have depression and anxiety, that is the key to living, is being intentional about your life and what you want to do with your life.
Yeah, that was amazing. And thanks for, you know, just going over those steps. And we definitely want to include those steps in the show notes so that people have a clearer picture of, you know, what they can do immediately. Now, before we wrap, I wanted to take some time to talk about one of our first conversations. And, you know, you were sharing with me about your grandfather and his values, you know, so I'd love for you to just touch on the values that you still live today and that he embodied during his lifetime.
Yeah, my grandpa, he was an amazing man. He was a Tuskegee Airman. He was actually a mechanic for the aircrafts. So the Tuskegee Airmen had six like guiding principles that they went by. And I love my grandpa because he always brought him up and he was always very proud of who he was. And I'll tell you just a quick story about him. They had, you know, this was back when the military was kind of segregated. And so when they desegregated the military, it was still kind of segregated, being honest. And so they said, yes, you can work on planes. Yes, you're going to be able to work on planes, but you're not going to be able to work on any white pilots' planes. So they gave him this old raggedy plane. He tells me the story all the time. They gave me this raggedy plane that was like all broken down. And they're like, here, you're going to have to fix this. This is what you're going to have to work on. And he worked on it and fixed it. And when the pilot came to test it, he was like, this is one of the best performing planes I've ever flown. And, you know, my grandpa said, I always knew that I could do it. I never doubted myself for one second. And I remember going to the Marine Corps gala with him. And one of the guys, you know, came up to him and he said, oh my gosh, you know, I heard that you were a Tuskegee Airman. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for being here. You guys were really good. And my grandpa paused him and he's like, we weren't good. We weren't great. We were the best. And I love when he tells people that, because I'm just like, you tell him, Grandpa. And so the guy was like, yeah, you guys were the best. And it kind of just paused him for a minute, because my grandpa was always very confident in who he was, despite the things that he went through at that time, where it was very hard to be in the military as a Black man. And so the six guiding principles of the Tuskegee Airmen that was embedded in his soul was: aim high, do not be mediocre, do not even think about mediocre, aim high. If you have a goal, aim high. Believe in yourself. Doesn't matter what anybody else says to you, doesn't matter what anybody thinks of you, you believe in you. When they gave him that plane, they definitely believed that he wasn't going to be able to do it. They definitely thought he was going to be working on it for years. He was going to get frustrated and probably quit. And he always believed, not for one second did he doubt that he could fix that plane. Use your brain. You know, think. He's always telling, you know, young people, think before you act. And that's kind of what going into being intentional as well. Use your brain. You know, think about, use what you've been taught and what you know to make informed decisions. Be ready to go. You know, we have that saying now is stay ready so you don't have to get ready. Be ready to go. At any point in your life, you could be needed for something imperative. Someone can need your gifts. Someone can need your talents. And I know I've squandered a lot of the blessings that God has given me, not being ready to use what he's given me to help heal others. So being ready to go, making sure that you're, you know, always ready with whatever gifts God has given you. Never quit. Quitting is not an option. I remember coming home with, you know, a C, and him being like, that's good, but it's not an A. And so you need to figure out how to get an A. Not quitting. It's not an option. You don't get to quit. That's not how it works. When you're in the air and you have other pilots depending on you, you don't get to just say, this is too hard, I'm done. Because other people's lives depend on you. And even in the real world, we have people that depend on us that we don't even know about. When you have pain from depression or anxiety and you get through that, my people are dependent on me to tell my story. So I'm not allowed to quit, because there are other lives that are dependent upon the information that I have, the experiences that I've had, and the stories that I will be able to tell. My other people's lives are dependent upon that. So I'm not allowed to quit. The last thing is, expect to win. Your expectations of yourself is what is going to propel you into your future. I expect this to go well, so it's going to go well. Expect to win. Do not let negative thoughts keep you from thinking that you can do anything. So those are the principles, and those are the conversations that we had over and over and over. And anytime I come up against a challenge, and even when I was in the hospital, you're not allowed to quit. There were times and days where I did have suicidal thoughts before I got to the hospital, with dealing with anxiety and depression, thinking that I'm going to end up just like my brother. But it was my grandfather's voice of, you're not allowed to quit. Never quit. That really was like, there's people that are depending on you. So really being able to keep those core principles, I think for young people, he would go around to different schools, colleges, middle schools, and teach in depth on those six principles. And it's really funny because he taught on the six principles of the six guiding principles. And now I'm teaching on the six lifestyle changes. And so it's kind of cool to see how his grooming has groomed me to be able to go around and talk about the six areas of lifestyle that need to be changed and incorporate his six guiding lines. So it's beautiful.
No words. Such a powerful and touching story. And I love, you know, that moment at the Marine at the ball where, you know, he states a fact that so many people overlooked. And I know that for many of us, being the best has become cliche, but to those who embodied it, like your grandfather, that was such a bridge to why we're here today and why we can do this work and continue to share and walk in the shadow of his legacy and continue, you know, to empower people all over the world. Now, I want you to just take some time, tell people how to connect with you online, tell people how to connect with you if they need to have your message on their platform or to bring you in as a speaker, because you do that as well. And then we can wrap this powerful two-part series. And I don't want to gloss over how much information you have given people. And I challenge the listeners to connect. Not just like, follow, and those things. You do those things. but also to help keep this conversation going, because I think we're losing too many people because we are not asking the right questions. We are not continuing to ask questions until we find answers that work for us. And at times we're just giving up. And I love that one of the, you know, the principles was to never give up. So just tell us how to connect with you and give us some parting words of wisdom.
Yes, I really, and before we run out of here, I just really wanted to say, with Black History Month just passing up, just ending, I really wanted to be specific about the Black community and getting help with mental health and mental illness. I know that mental health issues are more rampant in areas where people are impoverished, people are in prison. 60% of people that are in prison are from, you know, a minority community, either Black, and so they don't always have the proper resources. The Lee Thompson Foundation, Lee Young Thompson Foundation, based in Georgia, is helping to break the stigma off mental health, off mental issues. Growing up in a Black home, being in the Black community, having an issue with depression and anxiety, you were called, quote unquote, crazy. There is a huge stigma around it. So I'm also challenging my Black community to come together, to log on to that website. It's the Lee Young Thompson Foundation. They have a ton of resources. They have so many different exercises and platforms, events, just everything you can think of. Go on there, a look around. I really want to encourage you and even challenge you to do your research. You're not crazy. If you are dealing with depression and anxiety, you are not crazy. You are in good company. There are a lot of celebrities. There are a lot of powerful people, including myself, that have struggled with it. So you are not alone. It is something you should be able to talk about bravely. And like Bernard said, let's keep this conversation going. I have a website up. It's called What Nausea Did and Heals. Everything that I do is on there. There's a blog on there. I have a 6-week study guide that is coming out, designed to help build community. One of the huge areas of lifestyle change is social connection. And so when I was designing this 6-week study guide, I kept that in mind, that I want to start building social connection. So it's designed to be a journey through with, you know, two or more people. You get in a small group, whether it be at church, whether it be just at home with your friends or neighbors. You guys talk real raw questions. The first question is what does depression and anxiety mean to you? And kind of just going around in a circle and asking each other, so have you dealt with depression? What does it mean to you? And then going into the facts of what it actually is. It kind of gives you a couple of different test questions where you can kind of gauge where you are in your life with depression and anxiety. It also gives you like lifestyle quizzes. Like, so on this day, how many, you know, times do you actually walk? It has so many different mindful exercises, just great things. It's 6 weeks of studying, of growing, of building community. That's going to be up on my website next week for you guys to be able to download. I'm really encouraging small groups at churches to do it, because what I learned is that a lot of churches don't have the answers either. They're not properly equipped to be able to help young people in the church navigate through depression and anxiety. So this 6-week study guide will also help with that. So I'm encouraging pastors and small group leaders to go ahead and grab a copy as well. You can, like I said, reach me at What Nausea Did in Heals on all platforms. And nausea is spelled N-A-J-A-H. And it's exactly how it sounds, What Nausea Did in Heals, HEELS.com. And that's also my Instagram handle. Slide in my DMs. If you have a question, if you just want to talk to me, if you want me to pray for you, if you want me to help facilitate a small group, anything like that, send me a message. You can send a message through the website. You can send me a message through Instagram. I'm open. I love meeting new people. Give me a little bit of time to get back to you, but I promise I will. I'm super thankful to you, Bernard, for having this platform and letting me be able to speak to your audience. I'm super open to doing podcasts and speaking wherever I can. I'm going into more depth in my story. I know we had a limited time on these two episodes, but I am going to be coming out with a book this summer called Pain Not Wasted. And he shared a part of that book on our first part. And so that's going to be a more in-depth of my story and the things that I've been through and been able to overcome in my life. And so I'm excited about the future. I definitely think that I'm looking at the way things are going, and we are starting to break the stigma off of depression, anxiety, and open the door for people to have this conversation, the more celebrities that are struggling with it, and you know, a lot of celebrities have ended their lives, is being brought to the forefront more. So I'm kind of excited about where this conversation is going to go in the future, for sure.
Powerful, powerful. And again, thank you for not just the courage, but going on the journey to personally understand how to breathe again, how to find your voice and live as vibrant as you are destined to. I think that is so needed, especially right now. And thank you for just your time and preparing for these two episodes and really going as in depth as you have to create a conversation that can really empower people to find the change that they need for their lives. Anything we can do to help, please let us know. Thank you again for your time. This has been so informative for me and so transformational as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Bernard Bergen podcast. Leave a comment with two things you learned and one challenge to the information. Like and share this episode, and feel free to recommend topics we should cover on the podcast.
Are you proving them right, or are you proving them wrong? I mean, we all have haters. We all have doubters, naysayers, people who just don't believe we're capable of doing what we said that we were going to do. It's your job to prove them wrong. Not because their opinion matters, because you're still called to do exactly what wakes you up at night, what keeps you up at night. That's never going to change. So no matter who doubts you, no matter who's not in your corner, no matter who's not standing beside you as you face obstacle after obstacle, it's your job to prove everyone wrong. And the first person you need to prove it to is yourself.
The Bernard Bergen Podcast is brought to you by BernardBergen.com. Visit for more on human performance insights and results coaching.